The world-famous Conservation Canine Camp will next be running in southeast Queensland, Australia, from the 21st to the 25th of August. Join us with your dog to start your journey into conservation detection. Visit padfoot.com.au to book your place today. Isabel Grock, welcome to the Conservation Canine Podcast. It's great to have you on the show.
Well, it's great to be here, James. Thank you for having me today.
No. I've been trying to get you. We've obviously been trying to get a time in the calendar for a little while. And, you know, what with COVID and everything, it's been a bit difficult, hasn't it? How are you feeling now? You had a reaction to your immunization, didn't you, or your booster?
I did. Actually, this is why I know we've been trying to connect for a long time, and I was even trying to get to manage a trip to Australia to do more research for the book on conservation canines, and COVID always seems to get in the way no matter what. So recently I did get my booster and then got sick. So can you believe it?
Yeah.
No, but I'm here now.
Yeah, which is great. So for those who haven't heard of you or aren't aware of your work yet, let's just start by talking a little bit about who you are, what you do, just by way of introduction.
Of course, yes, James. So my name is Isabel. I'm a writer, a photographer, a filmmaker, book author, and I focus on wildlife conservation, endangered species, and the relationships between people and the natural world. As you can tell from the accent, I grew up in France, but I've lived in Vancouver, Canada, for the last 25 years at least.
You weren't tempted to go to the French-speaking side of Canada?
No, you know what? But because, first of all, the accent there from people in Quebec is very different from the French we speak in France. So I was too embarrassed to admit that I would probably not understand what they're talking about. So I avoided that. And also there's the climate. I grew up in the southwest of France, which tends to be warm, even though now it's getting too warm with a changing climate. In the summer, it's hardly bearable. But I didn't feel like wanting to face the cold winters in Montreal. So I just came to live in Vancouver, where I had never been before, but it looked like a fantastic place with an ocean, mountain, and so I just came to take that adventure, and I haven't never left since, so it's home now.
Great. So let's kind of take you back to the beginning then. So how did you end up in this kind of line of work? What drove you through to doing what you do now?
Yeah, it's a great question, James. It's actually started when I was a child. I was growing up in France in a town in the southwest, a small town really far from the ocean, near Toulouse. And I so remember distinctly, I was with my parents one evening. We were watching television. I must have been 9 or 10 years old. And there had just been a massive oil spill in France that affected the coast of Brittany. And I saw those images, and I saw the images of the seabirds covered in oil. And I stopped what I was doing, and I was completely glued to the screen. And I remember people, they were pretty desperate there in Brittany, and they were asking for help. They said, we need help, volunteers to help us clean up the shorelines and clean up the birds. And I said to my parents right away, I want to go there and help save the birds. And, you know, my parents, I can imagine their reaction. They said, no, you're not going. You're going to stay in school. And I said, okay, well, I was pretty disappointed. But for me, it was a turning point in the sense that I realized that, you know, it was those images that I saw on television that made me want to take action. And remember where I grew up in this town near Toulouse, no ocean. So I've never been to the ocean, never seen the ocean, never been to Brittany. I never seen a seabird in my entire life. So I had really no personal connection to that environment. And yet it was enough for me just seeing what had was happening there and the environmental devastation. It devastated me and I wanted to take action. So I became curious about the people that actually produced those images. And then I realized after doing a little bit of research that there are people called journalists, photojournalists, photographers. And I said to myself, this is what I want to do. When I grow up, I want to be a photojournalist and I want to write and document environmental issues so that we can better protect the natural world. So I kept that promise. I graduated from high school. I went to university in Paris, a big city. And then after that, I went to New York where I did a degree, a master's degree in journalism. I specialize in photojournalism. And after I graduated, did a number of things and then ended up in Vancouver where I started doing this. So following scientists in the field, conservationists all over the world, really to document different species and what people were doing to learn about species and wildlife at risk and how to protect them. And just telling those stories, really. So that's how I got started.
It's just fascinating. There's so many questions I could go into on that. But what I thought we'd start with, because obviously we've got quite a lot to talk about in the conservation, you know, canine world. But before we get into that, I thought it'd be nice to talk about your new documentary that's just been released, which I haven't managed to see yet. I'm desperately trying to work out how I can watch that in this part of the world. But, so maybe you can touch on that as well. But we'd like to talk about what the documentary is and just tell us about how that came about and what the challenges and successes were with making that.
Oh, for sure, James. Yes, I'm really excited because this documentary is just now being released. It's going through film festivals now, and it's always so special to finally bring that story to audiences because documentaries take such a long time to make. It's been 4 years in the making and through COVID, it started before COVID. And so I'm really so excited now to get to bring that to audiences and watch people's reactions as they see the film, discover it, and particularly the Q&As after the screenings, interacting with people who've just watched the films, and then the debates and the interactions. It's just absolutely magical to be able to finally do that. So how it came about is, so I've always been in my career, I could never decide. Some people decide, okay, they're going to be writers. Others decide that they're going to be photographers. Others decide to be filmmakers. I really wanted to do it all. I could never choose. So for me, telling stories is about combining words and images and films as well. So I've always played with all these different ways of telling stories. And one of the things I've been really passionate about is the relationships between people and wildlife and how we interact with the wild. And this film came about, it's about wolves and it's called Part of the Pack. And it's about the relationship between people and wolves. And in Canada, where I live in British Columbia, people have a bit of a love-hate relationship with wolves. They've been persecuted and hunted and tracked down and eliminated. And the wolves have tried many times to make a comeback to BC. And now they have come back and they're coming back on Vancouver Island, for example, in British Columbia, in spaces that are not like the spaces or landscape that were like 200 years ago. There are a lot of more people on the landscape now. So that means that those wolves, while they're more accepted by people, they have to navigate spaces where people want to be as well. So natural habitats are shrinking. So that leads invariably to more encounters between people and wolves and wildlife. And the film is about how we navigate those relationships and how we interact with the wild, trying to preserve spaces for wildlife to navigate and do what they need to do. And in this film, I wanted to explore the whole spectrum of the fascination that people have for wolves. So we follow three different stories and three different characters. One of them is a woman who had heard of who lived in Victoria on Vancouver Island, and she's heard of this lone wolf on this little island. And so she went out and studied the wolf because she was so curious about it. And so she developed that relationship with this wolf. And then eventually the wolf got off the island and went into different areas, urban areas. And anyway, so ran into conflicts with people. So it's all about that relationship. And then the other parts of the story is about people that love wolves so much that they want to bring them in their living rooms. So they adopt these dogs that are actually wolf dogs that are 99% wolves, because they have that passion for the wild and they just want to be close to the wild every second. So the film is really about, well, the ethical implications and behavioral implications of that fascination that we have with wolves and wildlife in general, and how can we have healthy relationships with those animals without necessarily wanting to domesticate them or bring nature to our homes. So that's what the film explores. And in terms of how can you see it, so I'm hoping one day it'll come to Australia in a festival. But right now it will be it's going through different festivals in the US and Canada and in Europe as well. And it will be on a TV channel called the Knowledge Network. And I don't know about the streaming, but hopefully it'll become available worldwide, but I'll keep you posted when it does.
Yes, so you can see it. Yes. No, absolutely. Do try and keep us posted, because it sounds like a fascinating exploration. It's always one of those very difficult things, I find, that it's very easy to take a sort of an idealistic view on such things, but it doesn't really get you anywhere. That, you know, like, there has to be a sort of a pragmatic solution to those instances of kind of human wildlife conflict and the different views and the different players, you know, and different kind of dynamics, you know, that occur. So it's, did you find anyone, sorry, something's ringing in the background here, that's very weird. It's not me either.
Do you need to take that? Maybe it's a call. Someone's
no, it's not even my phone. I don't even know where it is.
Okay.
Yeah, very odd. Yeah, my wife must have left her phone here or something.
No worries.
So anyway, apologies to listeners for that. However, what kind of, out of the festivals it's been at so far, you said it was great getting the questions and so on. What have been some of the more interesting or thought-provoking kind of questions or observations you've had?
You know, the fact that people realize that, you know, the films, while it's primarily about wolves and how we interact with wolves, it's really a film that people can relate to, because they have stories about interacting with other wildlife, whether it's bears or foxes or raccoons or cougars. So I think it has had, it's resonating with people in the sense that they get them to reflect on their own footprint on the landscape. So if you're walking in an area and there are wild animals, how should you be behaving? Should you try and get close and take a picture? Should you try and keep your distance? So yet those encounters become more frequent as natural spaces are shrinking and more wildlife are coming into urban areas where we live. So we have to share those spaces increasingly. So I think the film got people to think about, to reflect about their own behaviors and their own interactions and how that is impacting them to have a healthier relationship with wildlife. So I was really pleased to see that, because these are local stories we're telling with those documentaries, but they have somehow more of a universal resonance that each person can take a bit of the lessons learned from these characters and the struggles, what they're going through in the film, and think about, well, how does that impact me, or how does that get me to perhaps rethink the way I impact wildlife when, for example, I am, you know, out there in my backyard and I leave food out or, you know, or have a fruit tree and then the bear comes to my backyard and gets habituated. So how do I change my behavior so that we can keep the wild wild? So anyway, so I was really surprised by that, that the fact that it has that universal appeal. And then the other thing that really intrigued me is that being a documentary, we don't tell people how to think, what to think. So there's no call to action about you should do this or that. But a lot of people, after they've seen the film, really wanted to say, what can we do? They actually were looking for a call to action. What can we change? The policy, for example, about not allowing people keeping, you know, 99% wolves at home. Should we change the policy? Can we do something? Or maybe protecting wolves and not having them hunted, because in BC it's legal to hunt wolves, for example. So, and I was really inspired by the fact that a film could get people to not just think, but also wanting to act. Because to me, well, this is what it is all about. It kind of brought me back to the 10-year-old little girl that I was when I saw the birds covered in oil and wanting to do something. And I realized that people today in a world where we're faced with a climate crisis, a biodiversity crisis, there's a huge appetite for people to wanting to act and make a difference. So these are maybe a couple of things that really inspired me in those early conversations with audiences at the screenings.
Yeah, that sounds great. So talking about then the actual production of the documentary, have you got any interesting or cool stories or, you know, that you can tell about when you're actually filming or engaging with, particularly the wolves, obviously?
Oh, yeah. I mean, tons of stories. One of them is about people, actually, rather than the actual wolves. It's because these are our stories, like stories that are really character-driven. So it's not narrated. It's we're following people in their lives. We follow them over 4 years, and things have happened. There's a lot of drama, tragedies. I don't want to reveal what's happening in the film, obviously, but there's ups and downs and things that we didn't expect. And when it comes to having people participate in films like that, where they expose their lives and they expose themselves to potential criticism or controversy, you have to build a significant amount of trust. I can tell you, James, not everybody wants to speak on camera about having wolf dogs, you know, and living with wolves at home. It's not something that... it's a bit of a difficult thing to do. So building trust with people over time and our characters has been really something that I've been really proud of, because when we started up with that concept of a film, it's just a concept. Then finding individuals that are willing to go on this journey and being filmed at home, being filmed through what they experience, the good, the bad, and the ugly, it is a really, for me, one of the main achievements of the film. A film like that is getting into their lives and the intimacies of their lives. In terms of encounters with wolves, yeah, I mean, it's part of the film was to film wild wolves, coastal wolves. Coastal wolves are subspecies of wolves, and they live off. I'm not sure how familiar you are with it, with these, but they are live from what the sea brings them. So they feed off salmon and marine mammals, and they patrol the shorelines looking for from the dinner table from the sea, really. But they're very elusive. They're very difficult to film, and they cover huge amount of territory. So we set out because we needed this this footage for a film. You know, it's how can you make a film about wolves without wolf footage? So we went out on this island and looking for wolves, and every single day going out every single day. And the first day, we come out, and then there's this encounter with a young wolf, like a juvenile. After maybe only an hour, that was our first day, an hour with being there setting up, and we're told by our guide, oh, come here, maybe a wolf will appear. Oh, yeah, right. And then that wolf, single wolf appeared and just walked by us and looked at us. And we said, oh, my God, that is amazing. What an incredible encounter. We were even thinking with my videographer, I mean, filmmaker, cinematographer, this is going to be the opening shot of our film. We're thinking, oh, wow, that's amazing. And so we're very confident. We had about a week to film that. And actually, that was the last encounter we had for another 5-6 days, where we were spending 16, 20 hours out there in the field waiting for the wolves, looking for the wolves, and there were no encounters. So by the end of the week, our morale was really down, and we were like carrying our heavy gear going into this territory. I mean, to be honest, if we had had conservation canines to help us identify where the wolves were, it would have been so useful, but we didn't have that. So we had to be patient and humble. And finally, on our very last day, again, we found a pack of wolves there for us to film. But it's really a lesson in how difficult wildlife filmmaking can be, and you never know what's going to turn up. And so it's just being about in the moment and being humble, and whatever you get is what you get. So it's a couple of stories there of filming there in the field and learning about that.
Yeah. I think that's really great information for people, because we've got quite a lot of young listeners, and I've spoken to a few people who listen to the podcast, and they're obviously interested in the work of conservation dogs, but they're generally interested in conservation more broadly, and a lot of them have got a great interest in sort of filmmaking and that side of things as well. And yeah, in the past, in the distant past now, but I spent a certain amount of time working with the people from the BBC Natural History unit, you know, who do the kind of the Planet Earth documentaries and all those old Attenborough documentaries. And they would always say to me that it's patience and luck, you know, more than anything else. You know, the amount of time, like you watch one of these awe-inspiring sequences in a documentary, and it might have taken them 18 months. You know, of sitting on a cold rock to get that one. So it's everyone sees the glamour.
It's exactly. everyone sees the glamour, but it is a lot of hard work. And, you know, you're in the cold, in the hot, in the rain, in all sorts of conditions, and you're there hoping for the best, and the wildlife doesn't show up and turn up. And so it's a lesson in being humble, certainly, and being in the moment in that landscape, and having a huge feeling of gratitude when it does happen, and you just do have those encounters. So for this film, we're really on these two fronts at the same time, where we're building trust with characters, individuals that are slowly opening up to us, allowing us to film them with this relationship with these animals, and at the same time being in the wild. And hoping that we can also have these encounters as well. So it's a bit like, honest, it's not so different from when people that work with dogs, dog handlers, spend time in the field with their animals looking for scat. Everybody sees the glamour of, oh, you out there in the field, but it's also long hours and so much work covering huge terrain. So there's a parallel there in terms of what it takes to achieve that goal, really.
Yeah, so that's a beautiful segue into my next question then. So how did you first learn about conservation detection dogs?
Yeah, you would think, how would I get interested in dogs after spending so much time with wildlife and with wolves? You know, I guess there's a connection between wolves and dogs for sure, as being, you know, dogs are coming from wolves. But it's actually while I was doing a short film on an endangered frog that I first came across detection dogs. So it was in British Columbia, not too far from where I live, in a wetland area, and we were filming the efforts of a biologist who were trying to learn more about what is called now Canada's most endangered amphibian, the Oregon spotted frog. So the Oregon spotted frog is a beautiful frog with golden eyes, magical, beautiful. There's only a few hundreds of these frogs left, very sadly, and they only live in British Columbia. So they're endangered, and there's just a few populations. And the scientists want to certainly learn more about their habitat and where they are. And they're really keen on discovering new populations because, as you know, if you want to protect a species, you need to know something about their habitat and where they are so you can do what you can to protect this habitat. The only problem for these scientists is the frogs are very shy. They don't know that there's scientists out there wanting to help them. So they are in these wetland areas, hiding in those tunnels. They're camouflaged very well. So for scientists, biologists to find them, it takes hours and hours during a really short period of time during breeding season in the spring to go through these landscapes and find the frogs. And it's a landscape that's really hard to navigate. You sink like knee deep. It's very muddy. So anyway, so I was there filming that, those biologists in their effort to find the frogs. And that particular day I was out there with a cinematographer and we found a dog and we're not told prior about any dog. So I was like, what, there's a dog in there in this whole really sensitive habitat. That's not right. And then I quickly realized that this was not any dog. It had a vest and it was a working dog and there was a dog handler with this dog. And so that dog was it was an Australian cattle dog and her name was Ali. And Ali was with a group at the time called Conservation Canines, now Rogue Detection Teams. And the dog handler was Heath Smith, and they had been actually hired together as a team to give a hand to these scientists and help find the frogs. And so actually it was completely fascinated to see how Heath was working with Ali as a team to help Ali. And Ali was using her nose to find this Oregon spotted frog. We call it precious frog as well. And really quickly, she kind of found a frog. So It was an amazing moment, and I could see the scientists were really excited at this discovery and the possibility, because here and there they're spending thousands of hours trying to find those frogs, and this dog shows up and boom, find the frogs. Like it really knew what it was doing. So at that point, I became really curious about these dogs. So I spoke with Heath about this and the work that he was doing. So he really educated me on conservation canines. And I didn't know those existed. I had heard about the dogs in different roles of looking for drugs and search and rescue, all these roles that you hear about dogs finding explosives and things like that. But I didn't know that dogs could help with wildlife conservation. And for me, it was a match because, you know, I was interested in wildlife. I'm interested in how people help wildlife. And here you have another animal helping wildlife. So from there, I really set out to learn as much as I could and followed rogue detection teams around in a couple of other projects. And that's how it started.
So how long ago was that? Because, and we'll come on to the book in a minute, but I've seen some photographs in the book of a very young looking Heath Smith. So how long ago are we talking?
I know. Going to be upset. Yeah, it was about 10 years ago. 10 or 11 years ago. And Ali was around 8 or 9 years old. So she was really a very experienced conservation canine and actually tried to, because Ali was the one who inspired me to write the book, because she was the first one that I met and I followed Ali's adventure in detecting all these species. I had the dream of being reunited with Ali in her later years. COVID hit, so I couldn't travel. And finally, this year, I had planned after we could travel again to meet up with Heath and Ali. And Ali was just about to celebrate her 18th birthday. And I was all set up to go and photograph Ali and Heath and the team. And sadly, she passed away just a couple of weeks before I was able to see her again. And I was really sad. At the same time, you know, what an incredible story of how long these dogs can live, because they have a rich life. They're really so well looked after with the family, their human partners in this. So anyway, I did get to photograph Heath. So 10 years after, and you know, it's incredible to see the continued passion and meet some of their conservation canines, the working ones. The one that I got to photograph 10 years ago, one of them is Pips, that now is 13 years old. And then to meet one of the other dogs that is now retired with Heath and Jennifer at Rogue Detection Team's headquarters. And his name is Chester. And Chester is in November now, this month, he's going to be 19 years old. So wow. Isn't it incredible?
Yeah, so it's one of the great things about Australian cattle dogs, actually, is outside of their general personality, demeanor, ability, and so on, is just the fact that you actually get to spend more time with them than a lot of other breeds, you know, in their lives, yeah, you know, which is really good.
I think you can correct me, James, but I think the oldest, it's a record of the oldest living dog, was an Australian cattle dog, I think lived up to 30 years, something like that.
Yeah, so it's something absurd. Yeah, which is just incredible. But yeah, they've got a lot of fortitude, those dogs. So you followed Ali. Let's just stick on Ali for a couple of minutes. You followed Ali around a little bit a while ago. What's your favorite Ali story?
Well, you know, the favorite Ali story is that first Ali story, because with the frog, just because, you know, at that time, even the idea of detecting live amphibians was a bit of a wild idea. But 10 years ago, how could a dog do that? So I think it was, she was a pioneer in that sense, that it gave people like Heath and others in the field the ability to reflect on the fact that dogs, as when they're introduced to the different scent, they pretty much can do anything. It's really quite inspiring. So I think this is what the story for me sticks, because unfortunately I haven't been able to follow Ali again after that because of COVID. I wish I did, but I did follow others of the dogs that Heath has had over the years. One of them is Pips, which is another Australian cattle dog. And I followed Pips in Haida Gwaii, looking for scat of ermine species, very rare, very elusive. So I got to see Pips in action. And then 10 years later, got to see Pips again and learn about some of the incredible things that that he's done. And Ali as well, because Ali and Pips together, they've done, they really allowed scientists to find the first occurrence in 40 years of the Oregon silver spot butterfly. I think this is what it's called, which they hadn't seen the larvae in 40 years in the wild. So the dogs, they make incredible breakthrough, advancing science, advancing our knowledge, and ultimately advancing conservation. So it's fascinating.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the book then. So your book, Conservation Canines, How Dogs Work for the Environment, is an incredible book. And it's incredible in a couple of ways. It's incredible in that it is a great celebratory kind of product or thing I'm searching for the right word, but it's a great, it really highlights some of the incredible work, you know, that's going on around, yeah, all around the world. And so I wanted to talk about the actual kind of just development of that book, you know, because you must have gone around and spent more time with more cool people and cool dogs in more different places of the world than almost anyone. So, so let's talk about the book. Let's talk about who you spoke to in the book. Let's talk about who inspired you the most. Yeah, that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure, James. It's I'm really the kind of person I like to work on projects for a long time. Once I become passionate about something, I think I just follow the story and I realize that it's not something you can achieve quickly, that I really like to be immersed for a number of years. And maybe that comes from some experiences with some projects with wildlife where I found that, I want to photograph this species and do a story on this. And then you'd get there and then the wildlife doesn't show up, or it's not turning out as it is supposed to be. So it's really taught me the value of absorbing and being patient and spending time getting the story right. So I really spent 10 years researching that, and that has, you're right, brought me to really so many different places in the world. And now that I've finished the book, I'm like, well, I could write the sequel, Conservation's Canine 2, because now I found other projects in Australia, in the UK, and as I talk to more people, I see so many more things I could cover. So anyway, I started with that first encounter with Ali, and then I reunited with Heath Smits and went to Haida Gwaii, met with Pips. And then from there, it was just learning about all those different roles and all the different ways that dogs help wildlife or help with environmental issues. So I really was looking at what are those different ways. And it was a way for me to educate people at the same time as they were seeing dogs and what the dogs can do, really opening people's eyes and children as well on the variety of environmental issues. So, for example, wildlife trafficking. So dogs help with wildlife trafficking. So I heard of a project in Washington where the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife was trying to go after people that import illegal wildlife products like rhino horn and elephant ivory. So they got their first wildlife dog to help find those illegal wildlife products in ports, in containers. It's something that people would never be able to do. And for me, that was a way to show a dog working for this, but also to touch upon, well, what is wildlife trafficking and why it is such a problem and impacting populations. So the dogs were really a window into this large issue that the world is faced on. And then I realized as well, one of the other key critical environmental issues where the world is faced with in terms of biodiversity loss is invasive species that we don't want to cause harm. And I know in Australia, this is quite a bit of an enormous problem. I know some of your dogs help with introduced species like foxes, for example. Mm-hmm. So I found someone told me, hey, have you thought about profiling these detection dogs in Alberta that are detecting zebra mussels? They're an aquatic, tiny little species that are, once they take hold in those waterways when they don't belong, they really destroy the local ecosystems and they destroy infrastructure. And to me, it was fascinating to think about the fact that we have these detection dogs that can actually find and smell those little mussels. Isn't it incredible? So one thing after another, I really wanted to kind of really look at the whole range of those challenges that we have with the environment today in our planet and how dogs can help support and help and be part of the solution. And one of the aspects that I wanted to include in the book is coexistence. I think I told you that I've been always interested in coexistence and relationships between people and wildlife, and fortunately conflict. And so how can dogs help people better coexist with wildlife? So one angle in the book is around protection, livestock protection dogs, and how they help people accept and live with predators on the landscape. And another one was researching and featuring Karelian bear dogs that are being used in North America now to help reduce conflicts between people and bears. So it's really the whole spectrum of those environmental challenges and how dogs help. Don't know if that answers your questions.
No, it does. It does because it's a great resource for people, particularly people starting out, and obviously a lot of the focus of this podcast is to kind of obviously to celebrate the work that's happening around the world, but it's also to educate, you know, people that are new into the industry. And I think looking through your book, it opens people's eyes, because we can all become quite guilty of just concentrating on our lane. So you're aware of what you're aware of, and so you always think about the use of dogs maybe in endangered species, you know, surveys, or, you know, invasive, you know, use or something like that. But then people don't necessarily correlate guardian dogs to conservation so much in their mind, or even hunting dogs to a certain extent, yeah, into conservation. So it's nice to kind of have that broader view, because there's a lot of people that would want to work with dogs. There's not, sadly, enough opportunities for the number of people. So you sort of have to think outside the box a little bit, you know, to make your mark. And so having those, that awareness of those other areas, you know, is really good. So I saw that you kind of on that journey, you caught up with quite a few of our friends and previous guests on the podcast. And obviously you spent a lot of time with Heath and Jennifer, you know, and Colette and the Rogue teams, and Rita, you know, in Portugal.
In Portugal, and, I did go to Portugal. Yes.
Yeah. So, what really stood out for you? Is there a couple of particular? What I'm looking for is, what differences did you see sort of between the teams? What really, you know, kind of took you aback? What was surprising to you as you went through that journey?
It's a great question. I think there's a couple of things. First of all, the stories of the individual dogs, and the fact that these dogs are very often rescues from shelters, and they're really the dogs that nobody wants, right? Nobody wants. So they have this high energy. They're obsessed with fetch obsessed, and so they don't make good pets, and so they end up in those shelters and where they have no options there, and here comes along people like Heath or Rita as well, who worked in a shelter in Lisbon, and this is how she started at a very young age 14, volunteering for a local dog shelter and working with those animals, and really for these conservation groups or these dog handlers rather to see the special qualities of these dogs that nobody really had seen before, and giving them a second chance of being able to express what they are and do work for conservation and helping species that are often in the wild are also running out of options. So I think it's a story for me that's inspiring, this story of hope and resilience, and that you should not give up on those animals. And there's a sense of purpose. And I think it can really hold lessons for everyone. I think it's just not just for our relationships with animals, but maybe on ourselves. And sometimes when we feel like there's no hope and no options, it's something else, we can find a purpose. So that's one thing that's been a recurring theme in my research. And the second thing I'd say what stood out for me is the teamwork, is the connection between the people and their dogs in the field. And I know, just to speak for a minute about rogue detection teams for a minute, they really emphasize the fact that they're not dog handlers or dog trainers, but they're more
Heath's a cat person.
bound. Yeah, it's a cat. So am I. Actually, we have to talk about that for a minute. I know he's always been a cat person, and I am. I don't have a dog at home. I have a cat, so I guess it was a good connection between us there, right from the start. But I know he invented this term about the bounders, because they bound to their animals, they bound to the ecosystem. And to me, and they spoke often about the dogs being their teachers. And I think for me, it's really profound, because it's not, we often interact with animals and with dogs specifically as we tell them what to do. We don't spend enough time listening to the dogs, what the dogs have to teach us. And I think those conservation canines, it's a great opportunity to really remember and appreciate what the lessons we can hear from what we can learn from the dog. So seeing and being able in my photograph, because you know, as you know, being a writer and a photographer and working with images, one of the reasons I spent 10 years working on this book is that I just didn't do just the writing, but I went to all these places to do the photography, and I really aim to convey in my photographs the connection between people and their dogs and the incredible bond. So that's, to me, that's what stands out over and over again in every single project is that connection.
Mm. I think that's a great observation. I think you raise an interesting point. This is one of the things that I always admire most about the Rogue teams in particular, is that if you've got a lot of experience, so I know a lot of kind of old dogs people, you know, so hunting people, conservation dog people, and they all have that. I mean, they will all say, you know, if you're sitting around having a drink in the evening, they'll all say, oh, I've learned more from the dog than the dog's ever learned from me. And they've got that sort of intangible connection, yeah, between themselves and the dog. But they still use the same terminology. So they still talk about training the dog. They still talk about control. You know, they still talk about obedience, you know, because it's just the common vernacular. And what I love about Rogues and a few others in this industry is that they understand that words matter. And so they make very conscious efforts to sort of try and change that to better describe the way they work, because it'd be very easy just to use the common vernacular, but they really make that effort. From the perspective of obviously a word and visual person, yeah, you, yourself, how important do you think that is? I mean, when you're writing, how much time do you spend on making sure you've got the right word?
Yeah, I agree. Words matter, and I definitely think Rogue Detection Teams has really spent a lot of time using the right terminology, because you're right. I mean, trainer, handler, it's all convey those notions of you're in control and over your animal, and it's not about that. So it's really crafting words, and the right words does matter, as well as finding the right photos. The images are really, and for me, it's really a process that go hand in hand. You know, you can tell a story with words, and how are you going to convey those emotions? So this concept with a particular image, I think it's really, I spend a lot of time. And when it comes with a book like this, I'm very thorough, like you are, very detailed. And I have really very detailed conversation with people like Heath or people that I met in Montana as well, around the Carolean Bear dogs. All of this, I've done really very extensive interviews, and several of them. And I spent time in the field. It's not just about, you know, phone interviews. I'm very hands-on. I like to immerse myself and just see how they actually do it in practice. So and that's why maybe it takes so much time to do these projects somehow. But for me to get it right, it's important to really go into the details. So, and it's a back and forth as well, where we have conversations where just a dialogue. I mean, they're like, what do you mean by that? You know, I tend to be very inquisitive and push a bit the boundaries there.
Yeah, so that makes you a great person to ask the next question too, is which where do you really see the industry kind of going to? Because you've obviously, in some respects, you've been able to take that helicopter view over the sector a little bit, whereas a lot of us who are in the trenches, you know, are very focused in front of what's in front of our or our dog's noses. So what have you seen in terms of trends, and where do you think it might head?
You mean for the field of the conservation with using
conservation dogs? Yeah.
From what I understand, and again, I'm not professional working. I'm the storyteller, so I document those stories. What it seems to me is that more and more people seem to be getting in this field, and I would be perhaps attentive to. Do they really have that full of understanding of what it actually takes to work with these animals? And, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, sure, I'm going to use that method, that tool, you know, this tool. But it's actually a whole philosophy approach to this, which is more just, I'm going to get a dog and go out in the field and find stuff. So I think we have to be, and I think people like Heath and on Australia as well, and a podcast like this do a really great job at educating people on you know, there's a method here, and what does it really take, and how do we do this to make sure that it's not approach that I think it's, oh, well, yeah, let's just go and do this. I think there's more to it in terms of what it takes to be there in the field, the communication, the... Yeah, so I recognize and value the passion that people have. And, oh, I want to work with dogs. I want to do this work. I want to do something for conservation. But it has to be done in the right way, so people don't end up questioning the whole value of it, thinking, oh, well, the dogs don't work and they don't find anything. Or, you know, there could be a backlash there. So I'm sure you're probably very aware of, and that's something you discuss a lot yourself and with your peers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something we discuss a lot on the podcast as well, that it's, you know, it's a great industry. It's great to have the people interested in it. It's great for the dogs. It's great for conservation. But you can't go and do a short course and then go and hang up a shingle and say, I'm a conservation dog, you know, handler or a team, and start working, because, you know, unfortunately, dogs are still kind of under scrutiny. I mean, a lot of the hiring bodies of teams are still, you know, are well aware of dogs' capabilities and are very supportive. But, you know, in a lot of other cases, the jury's still out, I guess. And so we have to be very, very careful to make sure that that dogs are being presented, you know, with their full capabilities on show, not a dog that may be, you know, not right, coupled with a person that's not right, that may result in an inferior outcome than could have been achieved, you know, with a different approach or a different team. So,
exactly. I think it's really important. It's the right dog. It's the right person. Not every person is suited for this. And and this is a question I often get when I do these talks. The number one question, how do I get it? It's so great. How do I get into this field? And really, it's really not about the romance again of being in the field with a dog. It's a highly skilled job, and often, you know, Heath and others have told me, you know, the dogs learn quickly, but it takes a long time to train the people there, right? To learn to communicate with the dogs and support the dogs in the field and make a difference.
Oh, absolutely. And I always say to people, whenever we're training anyone, it's, you know, the romance is fleeting. I mean, sometimes you burst through into a beautiful landscape, or sometimes you see something amazing, you know, with your dog, or, you know, with a find or whatever. But most of the time you're spent sweating, cold, hot, steep terrain, hurting, picking ticks and leeches off unmentionable places. That's the reality. So it's there's not an awful lot of glamour there. And I guess you've experienced all that in the field, you know, as well with the photography work.
Oh, absolutely.
And you've got all that gear to carry around with you. you know. So,
oh, the gear and yeah, it's brutal. And people see the result, the images, and they're like, "Wow, I want to do this too." It's like, well, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. I would love to do what you do, but I'm fully aware I don't have the artistic eye or the patience. So, so let's just talk about. So before we finish up, what's next for you? What are you working on next or working on at the moment?
I'm currently working on another book, actually. So a book on hummingbirds.
Cool.
Yeah. And the reason it's a book about urban hummingbirds. So it's again, a bit of a relationship between people and hummingbirds. And they're very interesting, species anyway. So I'm working on that. I'm exploring a few film ideas at the moment. So because again, I feel like I want to write, I want to take photos, and I want to make films. So it's always looking at all these different things and how they interconnect. So it's a bit of an ecosystem of work there. That's where I am right now.
That's great. And are we going to see you down in this part of the world at any point?
You mean coming to? Yeah. Well,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, I'm coming to Australia.
I would love to come to Australia. I had actually, for the book, I came to Australia once, but I was going to return to actually include more of detection dogs, and then COVID hit, and that ruined these plans. But it's really on my mind because the dogs, conservation canines, they're part of me. I mean, I may have finished the book, but as I said, it's always something I'm interested in and following and looking to photograph more and do stories about in photos and films and anything I can, because it's such an evolving field. There's so many more stories, and Australia is definitely a place where I'd love to come. So I'm hoping in the next year, I hope. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Now that'd be great. So where can people buy the book for a start? So the book, for everyone's reference, Conservation Canines, How Dogs Work for the Environment, available on Amazon, all the usual places?
Or? Yes, available. And thank you. Available on Amazon and all the online usual booksellers. And from my publisher, Orca Books, the Orca Book Publishers, you can order directly from there as well. So
So where do you make the most? Because I'm super conscious that places like Amazon, you know, you make very little off the sweat of your own brows, a little as it were. So where should people try to order from?
You know, I always encourage people to order through their independent bookstores. Yep. I don't know how it works exactly in Australia, but I know in the US and Canada, and I've done talks with independent bookstores because I think it's really very important to support those community bookstores, people that have passion for books and really promote books that way. So I would encourage people to do that, to order through their local bookstore or through the publisher, my publisher directly. Sure. They can certainly do that. Thank you for asking, though.
That's a great message. And how can people follow your work, see what you're up to, watch little snippets of the movie, you know, all of that kind of stuff? How can they?
Yeah, of course. Yes. So on Instagram, I post all updates on Instagram. It's just my name. Maybe you'll post that on the podcast, but follow me on Isabel Grock on Instagram. Very easy. I'm on Facebook as well, and I have a website as well that I don't update as often as Instagram, but certainly that Instagram is a good way to get to follow my work and be updated on screenings for the film and talks about the book and all sorts of things and encounters of what I'm working on right now on projects and photos.
Fantastic. Isabel Grock, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, James. It was such a pleasure to connect.
Thank you for listening to the Conservation Canine Podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please like, share, and subscribe wherever you find us.